This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Well, we have a lot of news to cover from around the world on today's program, but we have to start with what had to be one of the wildest weeks in American political history. Impeachment, political defections, authoritarian crackdowns. For this, we'll go straight to Andrew.
Yeah, you thought last week was wild, but it just keeps crescendoing. I think we ended the program last week talking about how Facebook and Instagram had banned Donald Trump from their platforms and that Twitter had done a temporary ban. Well, over the weekend, Twitter made its ban on President Trump permanent, as had a host of other platforms, including Reddit, Twitch, Shopify, YouTube, Snapchat, TikTok, Apple, Discord, Pinterest, Stripe, and I haven't even heard of some of these, and probably President Trump has either. But in case he's thinking about using these these platforms
You're
in
not
the future,
allowed on here either.
He's not allowed on it. As had many of his more adamant supporters, Sidney Powell thrown off social media, Michael Flynn thrown off social media. I think the last statistics I saw there's up to 60,000 people. Just completely banned from social media. A number of them switched over to Twitter's more conservative rival, Parler, but now they're throwing them off. Like Apple won't host their app.
Right.
Microsoft won't host their app. Google won't host their app.
Yeah, just seeing that happen, I didn't even realize that these companies had that kind of power. It's been pretty illuminating.
Right, yeah. I think there's even been a few websites I've gone for stories that the mainstream media would never cover that are just coincidentally like either down for maintenance or suspended from the internet. So they're not even just off the apps. They're actually like fully thrown off the internet as they just crack down on anyone who claims that this election was rigged. Is going to have to start using Morse code or smoke signals or flash your flashlight from your window to try to get their message heard. As you're getting, I've seen a number of articles saying that like big tech's now like the fourth branch of the U.S. government or the incoming Biden administration, to where between Congress, the courts, the presidency, and now the big tech companies, you just start to control all aspects of society. And then, I mean, that's, again, a story you could go about for a long time, but there even as that was...
Just on this point, they're talking about, like, government agencies that decide what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And they're talking like the government just needs to take more direct action in making these determinations that is authoritarian on a scale that has never been witnessed in American history. They decide what the narrative should be, and then they decide anyone who doesn't go along with that is going to be blacklisted and silenced.
Even Angela Merkel in Germany and Emmanuel Macron in France were talking about how alarming what the big tech companies in America did to President Trump is. And I don't know, that's kind of humbling as an American when you've got the Germany and France lecturing you on the state of free speech in your country.
Right.
But yeah, like you said, that is authoritarianism on an alarming scale, and it's definitely something of a... It's what you're going to see even more than we've seen this week if a Joe Biden administration takes office.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, that was a huge story in and of itself that was kind of came out over the weekend. And then right into Monday, you've got the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. She'd already spoken with the Joint Chiefs of Staff about taking away President Trump's access to the nuclear codes, and introduced a resolution to Congress pressuring Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from office. Now, Mike Pence refused to do that, but they had introduced articles of impeachment instead, impeaching Trump of incitement of insurrection. I think specifically the incitement of insurrection articles accused Trump of willfully inciting violence against the government of the United States because of those protesters on January 6th who made it into the Capitol building. And that resolution actually passed. I think like all the Democrats who showed up, all 222 who made an appearance, voted for it, in addition to 10 Republicans. So mm-hmm. that was enough to impeach President Trump for incitement to insurrection. And now they're looking at a Senate trial. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that there's actually just looking at his schedule. He's pretty busy these days getting ready for Joe Biden's judicial picks and his cabinet nominations, says that they wouldn't be able to conduct that trial until after Trump leaves office, which raises some thorny legal questions as to, like, a Senate trial for impeachment is supposed to be determining if the president should be removed from office. So from McConnell's standpoint, it's kind of like, how can I conduct a trial about whether a man should be removed from office if we don't think he's going to be in office
right.
at the time of the trial. Although I think the logic, such as it is there's a section of the 14th Amendment that says anyone convicted of insurrection is permanently ineligible to hold public office. So that the Democrats are thinking that, like, well, if we can get him an officially convicted in the Senate of insurrection, then he can't run again in 2024 or as a senator or a congressman
right.
or any other, right? He's just permanently banned from politics.
Yeah. Yeah. They want to blot out the name of Trump from under heaven, really.
Right. It's basically, yeah. Our editor in chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, has drawn a lot of attention to that verse in 2 Kings 14, drawing the parallels between the Trump administration and the administration of King Jeroboam II in ancient Israel, where it says that the affliction of Israel was bitter, and there was no one to help. And God looked down and saw that, and said that I'm not going to allow the name of Israel to be blotted out from under heaven. So I'm going to save them by the hand of Jeroboam. And so you definitely see that parallel today, where President Trump, the Senate said he's lost the election. The House has impeached him for insurrection. The Senate's getting ready to hold a trial for insurrection. I heard that the Attorney General of Washington, D.C. is even considering arresting him when he's out of office. He's got immunity until then, along with his son and Rudy Giuliani and a couple other people. And so even 10 Republicans voted for the impeachment. Rumors in Washington is that Mitch McConnell is actually kind of happy that the trial's coming, because he wants to purge the Trump element from the Republican Party. So there's definitely no one to help, and they are definitely trying to blot out the name of Israel. I mean, you can definitely see that with the Trump administration. I mean, he's done a lot to help America or help Israel, and they're trying to pretend like he doesn't even exist. I think I saw a Babylon Bee article. It's like a satirical website that says that they're going to airbrush out Trump from all past reruns of The Apprentice television show he used to run.
Yeah. Well, the way that the logic that they're pursuing for this impeachment and this incitement to insurrection is really extraordinary. Here's a man who explicitly said, demonstrations are fine, please be peaceful. And they're basically saying, you know, him saying that you should be peaceful is basically really what he really means is don't be peaceful, that you need to be violent. So they're imputing motives behind what he's saying that directly contradict the words that he's saying. If he repudiates white supremacy, nationalism, white national, all of those things explicitly, they say, well, what he really means is this. So you, the way that they're viewing it and what they actually did this week, impeaching him for what they interpret his words to mean, this is a completely different alternate universe of
right.
the administration of jurisprudence in this country.
And extremely hypocritical, because even there's a constitutional law professor at Georgetown University, Jonathan Turley, who's pretty liberal, but also a constitutionalist, and that he wants things to be done through the constitutional checks and balances. And he's warning the dangerous precedent this sets, because they said President Trump called for a rally and asked for people to be peaceful, but there was some violence that broke out at the rally. So now they're impeaching him for willfully inciting violence, where he said, if you set a precedent of impeaching politicians when violence breaks out at one of their rallies, like half the Democrats in Congress could be impeached. Anyone who's ever supported a Black Lives Matter protest could be impeached, because most Democrat politicians who call for a Black Lives Matter protest don't explicitly ask for violence. One or two of them have, including even Nancy Pelosi has come fairly close
yes.
to asking for violent protest at her rallies. And so it's like President Trump's been impeached for inciting violence by people who have actually incited violence.
Mm-hmm. Watching this unfold is truly remarkable. It's just as dramatic as it could possibly be. And if you have not been keeping up with the news through the Trumpet Daily, Stephen Fleury is staying right on top of the latest details of this every morning at 7 a.m. on KPCG.fm, Central Standard Time. He's also been publishing articles this week based on that material. There are a few up there that you can look at, and we'll link to in the show notes. The appalling attack on American free speech. There's one called Nancy Pelosi's coup d'etat and impeachment in an upside down world. Go check those out. Really required reading for this past week and these events that are taking place here. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. While these authoritarian crackdowns are happening in America, another crackdown is taking place in Hong Kong. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, a big part of this story actually took place last week on January 6th. So, you know, that was the day when most of the world was focused on all that chaos at the U.S. Capitol. But on the same day that America was experiencing all of that, China was cracking down on Hong Kong to just an unprecedented degree. Before the sun came up that day, 1,000 police officers descended on the territory. They fanned out all across it. And by noon, these forces had raided 76 homes and offices and had arrested 53 people, including one American citizen. And the crime that these people had committed was basically standing up for human rights and democracy. These were labor unionists. There was an activist for rights of the disabled. There were some former pro-democracy lawmakers, also an activist for minority rights. And then the American is a lawyer. So this group included just about every prominent opposition figure in Hong Kong, and they were all arrested. And this all happened under the auspices of China's new national security law that was passed back in June. And on Trumpet Hour at the time, back in June when that law was passed, we said that that really marked the end of freedom in Hong Kong, because, you know, Hong Kong is supposed to be largely autonomous and democratic until the middle of this century. That's according to the treaty that China signed in 1997 when it took over the territory. But those new national security laws criminalized any kind of behavior that the Chinese Communist Party sees as subversive against Beijing. And of course, the party has nearly infinite latitude in how they can define that term subversive. And then the laws also established a police force to enforce those laws. And that force is above the law. You know, they conduct their searches, they implement their surveillance, all without any kind of court oversight. So they're basically paramilitary units authorized to use force however they want to in order to assert the Communist Party's will over Hong Kong. And, you know, back in June, some people may have thought that it sounded like a little bit of an exaggeration to say that Hong Kong's freedom was over. But this week and last week, after this raid took place, almost everyone is acknowledging that that really is the case now. Most of those people had taken part in a vote a number of weeks earlier, and China didn't like the way they voted for pro-democracy candidates. And so now they're detained and they could face life in prison. So this was the most dramatic attack yet in Chinese President Xi Jinping's war against Hong Kong's freedom and in his battle to transform it from the free city that it long was into a fully Chinese city of just, you know, complete submission to his authoritarian rule.
Indications are that China has even worse measures in store.
Yes, as terrible as last week was, there are signs this week that China's crackdown on Hong Kong isn't even close to being over. This week, reports emerged that Beijing is now in the process of blocking websites in Hong Kong, so it'll soon be like the situation in the rest of China, where the Great Firewall, they call it, that blocks out everything except what the government has sanctioned. So that's a clear blow to the freedom of information and the freedom of speech that are enshrined in Hong Kong's basic law. But China's still going forward with it. And of course, it's getting a little harder for U.S. authorities to condemn that sort of thing, given what Andrew just spoke about with America doing a lot of the same kind of blocking. But then reports from this week also showed that the Chinese Communist Party is introducing still more electoral reforms on Hong Kong, and those will further narrow the space for the opposition to operate in. So it'll be democracy with Chinese characteristics, and of course that's not democracy at all. This week they also hacked the electronic devices of many of those 53 detainees in order to find private information about others who have pro-democracy leanings. So I think we can expect another wave of arrests once that unbelievable breach of privacy is over. So it all points to just a dark and just a chilling reality for Hong Kong.
China continues to reveal its true colors through events like this. We've talked about its militarization, but this, say, over the South China Sea and elsewhere, this shows the kind of regime that China really is, that the more power it gains, the more we can expect this kind of activity to take place.
That's exactly right. It's authoritarian to the core. Their ultimate ambitions are not just to control, you know, China and its near abroad, but really they have their eye on the world. And so it's very alarming to see what kind of rule they would like to introduce globally.
Where would you send people to look for how this is important prophetically and what Bible prophecy tells us about what to expect from China?
Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has written an article. This was in the February 2020 issue, and it's called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And he really makes a powerful case in there, just showing that for decades, the British and then the Americans were the main global powers. And they used their power largely to stabilize the world and even to advance civilization for a lot of nations and peoples. That's probably more evident in Hong Kong than just about anywhere. But today, we see that Anglo-American era is ending, and the world is really transitioning into a dark new era. And Mr. Fleury points out that the Bible discusses this new era. It calls it the times of the Gentiles, and he shows that term Gentiles is in this prophecy mainly about two groups of people. One of them is led by Germany, the other one is led by Russia and China. And it's just a very powerful article to show the prophetic context of this transition that we're now seeing. So I would highly recommend that to anyone who would like to understand better.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. This assault on freedom and the political upheaval that we've been talking about, especially in America, in a way, it's not unusual. Europe is dealing with political crises in a number of nations. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's a bit like political dominoes or something. I guess they're not flipping each other, but lots of governments toppling in Europe right now. Italy's government stands on the brink after a key member of the coalition pulls out. The Dutch government, just before we went on the show, ended up resigning. And Germany, they've got a big meeting, again, going on right now and also going on tomorrow, that is going to go a long way towards determining who their next chancellor is and answering that question that people have been asking for 10 years or more, who is going to succeed Angela Merkel? So if we start with Italy, you know, Italy is the king of unstable governments. I think they've had about 60 since World War II. So you know, your average government doesn't make it to its second birthday over there. So in some ways, not too surprising. But what you have, there's a couple of things this revolves around. On the one hand, they've been hit very badly with the coronavirus pandemic and then the economic effects that all of the lockdown causes and things like that. They did not have a strong economy to begin with. They didn't have a particularly united government either. It's people with very different points of view. And so a big part of this is based on how do we spend this money to how do we spend European bailout money and other money in recovering from the coronavirus pandemic. There is a very interesting aspect, and maybe a little bit speculative aspect of this, that could be connected with the turmoil we're seeing in the United States. I think people aren't surprised to see political turmoil in Italy. I don't think anyone's ever surprised to see political turmoil in Italy. At the same time, there isn't really a huge reason for this to blow up right now. So what happened here is Matteo Renzi, the person that pulled out of the coalition, this former Italian prime minister, he was demanding certain changes on the coronavirus relief package. He actually got most of what he wanted. He said, you know, give me this or I'll resign. And the prime minister, Conte, said, okay, you can have it for the most part. He resigned anyway. So if this is raising a lot of questions, it's really not a great time to resign. You know, if you trigger the collapse of your government in the middle of an emergency, the main response from the people is generally, you know, what are you doing? We should be pulling together. We should be overcoming our differences. We should be finding our way through this, at least for now. And if you have a big disagreement, fine, but resign in 6 months' time when it's all sorted. So there's very little public support for him pulling out of the government, and he may well have done his party a lot of damage by doing that. But as Reuters pointed out a couple of weeks ago, there's another demand from Renzi that's very interesting, where he was also demanding that the Prime Minister Conte cede his control over the secret services. So he's also wanting much more control over the Italian intelligence service, which is interesting because the Italian intelligence service is very much in the news, at least not in the mainstream media, but on other parts of the media in the U.S. with their potential involvement in the U.S. election fraud and some of the things going on there. You know, there's been talk of reports of William Barr traveling over to Italy over the last year or two to investigate things that have been going on there. There've been various people caught up in the American election scandal have accused Matteo Renzi, the person who resigned, of back when he was prime minister in 2016, helping President Obama with things related to the Obamagate, this fraudulent investigation into President Trump. There's accusations he was working for Mr. Obama to try and find dirt or place dirt on the Trump campaign back in 2016. Mr. Renzi he sued one of the people involved for libel, claiming that that's not true, but that's the accusation. You go back several decades, you do have a history of the Italian intelligence agencies getting caught doing dodgy things with the CIA, most famously renditioning an Italian, he was a terrorist, but they illegally helped the CIA rendition him and move him over to Egypt. So you do have a plausible story here that potentially Renzi's torpedoing the government over concerns that some things that he did with the intel agencies could be on the brink of being uncovered. Like I said, I think that's speculative, but it does fit the available facts. It's hard to understand really why he decided to torpedo the government at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I would presume that if there is a real story there, that we're going to be finding out more about that, and probably relatively soon. So Italy's in turmoil. You mentioned the Netherlands.
Right. The Netherlands, this is a unrelated story in a lot of ways. What you have in the Netherlands is Mr. Rutte, the prime minister, in a previous government, still when he was prime minister, there was a basic tax accusers accused thousands of families of fraudulently claiming child support benefits, fraudulently claiming money from the government. His government stepped in and told all these families, you have to pay back this money. It was quite large sums of money. They weren't given a chance to defend themselves in court or anything like that. And an investigation came out very recently and said that these accusations were actually false, that these people that the government accused of stealing money and saying, you have to pay us back now thousands of euros, they didn't steal anything. And so it was that scandal, so kind of a very local scandal within the Netherlands, that has caused the government to fall. There are elections scheduled in the Netherlands for two months anyway, so it's kind of an interesting, like, it's toppled, but nothing is changing. They're just going to hold elections in 2 months the way they were going to do at this point. But still, it's another example of political instability in Europe.
Now, with Germany, this whole question of succession after Angela Merkel leaves the scene, as you said, this has been going on for years now, but we're really getting down to crunch time, and there's still a huge vacancy there.
That's right. I mean, she's kind of kept going longer than I think anyone expected her to. She has been getting through potential successors. Annette Kramp-Karrenbauer was her previous person who was going to succeed her. It was over a year ago, or almost a year ago, that she decided, and a lot of other people decided, she wasn't up to the job, and she resigned. Germany spent the last year thinking about this, I guess, dealing with coronavirus crisis. They've been, or at least the economic crisis resulting from that. They've still not managed to choose a leader, so it's finally gotten down to they're having a virtual meeting today and tomorrow, and by the end of tomorrow's meeting, and I believe it's on tomorrow, the delegates from Angela Merkel's party are going to vote on a new party leader. So Angela Merkel is going to remain Germany's chancellor. However, there is the German elections are scheduled for September, and Ms. Merkel has said very firmly on a number of occasions she is not running in any more elections. So unlike some of the previous leadership challenges, there is a very hard, fast, imminent deadline of when we have to have somebody in place. This can't just keep going now. But the situation here is you have three people that are up for election, and it's up for election by, like I said, about 1,000 party delegates. This isn't something that the public are voting on. But none of these individuals that are up for re-election have much support.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a huge amount of – nobody's really enthusiastic about them. A couple of them are pretty similar to Merkel anyway. There's a lot of various people, various news organizations that have just been talking about the void that is there at the top of Germany, the vacuum that is there, the lack of vision, the fact that there's no viable success. You know, I've been seeing this again and again and again across a whole range of European news outlets this week. Nobody expects tomorrow to fix that. Nobody's expecting really the leader here to be someone that fires up Angela Merkel's party, gives them purpose, right, helps them see what they're going to do. Instead, it looks like, however uninspiring or whatever you say about Ms. Merkel, she's been seen as a safe pair of hands. She is very popular right now. So tomorrow's vote is probably just going to expose that void and vacuum rather than fill it.
Now, if you can just sum this up quickly, all of this political turmoil that we're seeing in Europe, this is something that we're watching very closely because European politics feature very heavily and prominently in end-time biblical prophecy. I imagine that we're going to be talking more about Germany specifically once a new party leader is chosen within a few days, presumably. But maybe you could just talk about the big picture with respect to European politics, prophetically speaking.
Over the summer, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had an article, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. That's a great summary of that big picture here. But I just thought it was fascinating that with everything that everybody is talking was talking about with coronavirus, this is something that you weren't hearing about from anyone, but he really zeroed in on, watch the effect that coronavirus and the economic fallout has on Europe. He started that article saying one of the most important effects of the global pandemic over COVID-19 has been almost overlooked. Europe's response to the pandemic is accelerating the fulfillment of one of the most crucial end time prophecies in your Bible. And at least with Germany and Italy, you know, that is absolutely true. Coronavirus is at the heart of both of those problems, except the Netherlands may be a little different. But you know, Italy's fallout, all about how do we deal with this bailout? How do we, you know, our economy was bad. Now it's gotten even worse. How do we move forward? There's problems with poverty, but we don't have any money to pay for it. And we're part of the euro, so we can't print that money. You know, Germany, you've just had this. The euro crisis has just kind of put everything on freeze that has made this void at the heart of Germany's leadership become even more glaring. And so This is something that Mr. Flurry said. This is going to be one of the biggest things that comes out of the coronavirus crisis. And so it's really interesting to see now this January 16th weekend, we've kind of got three governments involved in some sort of political turmoil here. And this really could be, or this really is an important prophecy to watch. Mr. Flurry made those forecasts because the Bible has a whole load of specific prophecies about changes that are coming to Europe. Revelation 13, Revelation 17 are prophecies of a coming European power that's very different to the European power that we see right now. How is that going to change? Well, there's going to be some form of major crisis that helps revolutionize things. Coronavirus is going to play a huge role in that. And Mr. Flurry's article is a great place to go to get an understanding of that prophecy, of what these scriptures are saying. And this is also something, as you see the U.S. in turmoil, that Mr. Flurry's come back to again and again. You know, American politics are in turmoil, but we can't forget about the rest of the world here. America is kind of having all of its trouble while there are these other kings rising. Mm-hmm. And while these are going to, you know, these are going to come along, they're going to take advantage of that turmoil. So it's important to understand what is happening in Europe and understand those prophecies. And then you understand those prophecies and you see how God is in control in all of this, and it is all unfolding according to his plan.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. We will link to that, coronavirus in the Holy Roman Empire, in the show notes for today's program. A deadly set of airstrikes in Syria occurred this past week. To learn why and what it may signify, we'll turn to Brenton Octagall.
Yes, overnight on Tuesday, there was a series of airstrikes in eastern Syria, and this was reported by the Israelis, by Americans, and by Syrian media also. And it seems that Israel was targeting both Syrian fighters and, in fact, warehouses, but mainly the targets were Iranian and Iranian-backed militias that are working on the border here. This border between eastern Syria and Iraq, right across into the Syrian side from the Iraqi border, is a place where Iran stores a lot of its weapons before they transit further across Syria to get to some of its allies and become in range of the state of Israel. And in this specific strike, the United States intelligence has said that there were components inside these warehouses that could be used for Iran's nuclear weapons program also. And so we have seen this is the fourth attack in the past 2 weeks in this area of eastern Syria, and another couple inside western Syria also. And so we have seen a serious uptick in strikes by Israel against Iran inside Syria. Now, what was very different about this attack is that it came after a very conspicuous meeting between Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State of the United States, and also Yossi Cohen, the head of the Mossad, Israel's basically version of the CIA. And that meeting took place at a popular cafe in Washington, D.C. on Monday, and press saw the two meeting there, and they were wondering what would come of it. And then a day later, we have these attacks. And then a day after, this Wednesday, we had a United States official with intelligence on these matters confirming that part of the substance of that discussion was that the United States gave Israel the intelligence on the targets that they should hit inside eastern Syria. And this is this coordination has probably happened before. However, the United States was fine and even desirous that it would go public, that Israel and the United States working so closely in eastern Syria to hit Iranian targets.
So the Trump administration is about to go, by all appearances. And this kind of activity, this high-level coordination between America and Israel, this is the kind of cooperation between the two that has really been a hallmark of the Trump presidency. They've had very close cooperation with Netanyahu's government and staving off many threats to Israel over the time, and Israel has enjoyed unprecedented support. Is this a matter of trying to kind of squeeze the last bit of that while there is opportunity, or what do you see is going on here?
It could be. It definitely looks to be that way, in the sense that if Biden is going to come into power, then we're going to have a return to nuclear deal conditions. Israel was extremely limited in its ability to stop Iran from taking over Syria from 2012 all the way through till President Obama left office, because Iran basically told the United States, if Israel keeps attacking us there, we're done with the nuclear deal. It's over. There were a lot of things that were on the table that Iran put there that the United States had to then pressure Israel to not attack. And then when President Trump came into office, Israel had a green light to do what they want against Iran inside Syria. And so they've had almost 1,000 strikes actually in the past 4 years against Iran to try and prevent Iran from fully taking over Syria, and the likes of which they have done southern Lebanon with Hezbollah there. And so, yes, if Israel sees that one more week for President Trump, that's one more week of green light to go in and go hard. And it's hard to know whether, you know, there is more to it than just that, and whether Israel might perceive that they're not giving up on the Trump administration yet. The Israeli press has been absolutely furious at the prime minister for not doing more to cultivate ties with Joe Biden's transition, and to not do more to talk against President Trump. He hasn't said one thing against President Trump, even after last week and all the pressure that other Israeli leaders were putting on to try and say that Trump led some insurrection at the Capitol. Netanyahu came out and praised Trump last week, and the media over here went into a frenzy over it. And so I don't think Netanyahu has given up on Trump just yet, because it's dangerous to start speaking against Trump if there's any chance whatsoever that he remains in office. And so this next week could be one, or this next few days, let's put it that way, where we could see let's just say that attack that took place last Tuesday won't be a one-off. And remember, the Six-Day War happened in 6 days. It's a Six-Day War. And look what Israel could do in that time period. And so now that it has a green light, are we going to see more attacks from Israel with the help of the United States inside Syria? We'll see. Biblical prophecy indicates that there is if we look at the relationship between Israel and the United States underneath President Trump, and we look at the type that we've spoken about at length, and how President Trump does play the role of the ancient King Jeroboam, the modern type of that, there was a really strong military alliance between the southern kingdom of Judah, which is the modern state of Israel, and the northern tribes of Israel, led by Jeroboam, which the United States now is the modern descendants of. And so one of those key objectives militarily, the Bible brings out, was this territory of Syria. And so is that playing out? I don't know. But it certainly is interesting that the military alliance component of it anciently is taking place right now.
The links between Iran and Syria have been historically, in recent years, very close. The fact that Israel is attacking these is really, we've been seeing one among several factors that show fracturing of this relationship between these two, and that's something that we expect based on biblical prophecy.
Yes, for sure. And the media over here in Israel was drawing attention to this for the last couple of days since these strikes. They said that the relationship between Assad right now and Iran is not strong. There was a close confidant of the Assad regime that wrote a piece 2 weeks ago saying that Iran's the problem in Syria. You also have Assad's brother that is basically fighting against Assad right now because of his ties to Iran. And so there is a growing groundswell of reporting that says that if Syria is to go forward, Iran can't be there. And perhaps, as we know, looking forward for this next coming week, that President Trump is going to continue in office. Maybe Assad, seeing that there'll be four more years of strong sanctions on his regime, not just the Iranians, but Assad's, maybe he'll be tempted to actually motivate a change of alliances there. This, of course, is prophesied in Psalm chapter 83. It speaks about how the nation of Syria is not going to side with Iran. They are going to side with actually an anti-Iranian alliance. And so we have expected this for some time. Now, the United States playing a role in that division, that's probably a new wrinkle to it that we probably haven't expected and haven't necessarily seen. In the end, Assad is not going to be a U.S. Or a friend of the United States or even Israel. It's actually Europe, the prophecies bring out, that's going to benefit most from the division between Iran and Syria, and that's what we're watching for most. But perhaps in the meantime, it is the Trump administration and Israel that kind of forces Assad's hand there.
Well, Brent wrote a trumpet brief about this earlier this week. U.S. and Israel publicly acknowledge cooperation in Syrian strike. You can see that on thetrumpet.com. We'll link to that in the show notes. Thank you very much for that, Brent. The news this past year has been dominated by coronavirus, and in America, by domestic political issues. Amid all this noise, an important story has been overlooked, and that is 2020's record rate of weather disasters. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, with all the turmoil in the political world, there's quite a bit of turmoil in the natural world as well. The U.S. set a record with 22 major weather disasters this past year, costing at least $1 billion in damages. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And I actually have a write-up on that report from the Trumpet's Rufaro Manyepa in front of me. That announces that there was actually been 262 deaths in America this year due to weather disasters and $95 billion in total damages. So that blows past the previous record. In both 2011 and 2017, there were 16 major weather disasters that cost more than $1 billion. And so the ones this year, I mean, there's been just a mix of hurricanes, wildfires, windstorms, floods, all sorts of just different disasters that have cost a tremendous amount of money. And granted, some of that is due to just rising population. In years gone by, it was much less likely for a weather disaster to cost $1 billion in damage, because a weather disaster actually has to hit an area with quite a bit of people and infrastructure to accrue that much money. But still, the NOAA is confident that at least since they've been tracking $1 billion disasters in 1980, the actual number of natural disasters has been increasing. That means hurricanes are getting wetter, storms getting more violent, and wildfires fiercer. And that's something we've watched very closely at the Trumpet, just due to a number of prophecies in Job 37, verses 11 through 18, Deuteronomy 11, 17, verse 17, Deuteronomy 28, verse 22, Amos 4, verse 7, Nahum 1, verses 3 through 4, that talks about God bringing storms, floods, drought, fires, and other disasters to correct people. there's another verse in the Leviticus 26 verses 4-5 that God promises to give favorable weather and rain in due season to those to obey him, but to bring weather disasters on those who don't. And our booklet, Why Natural Disasters, gives the biblical view on why things like this have been getting more and more common for at least the past 40 years.
All right. Thank you for that. Andrew, we'll link to those resources in the show notes, Rufaro's article on the record weather disasters in the United States, and our booklet, Why Natural Disasters. How much has Russia improved militarily during the rule of Vladimir Putin? A new report looks at the advancements in the nation's air force. The answer is impressive. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this is a very detailed 38-page report by the Center for Naval Analysis, and it focuses mostly on the time from 2006 to 2019. And just to hit some of the high points here, it says that in that time, Russia's air forces received about 460 brand-new fixed-wing combat aircraft and also 360 attack helicopters and 110 Yak-130 jet trainers. And then besides these hundreds of advanced new additions, they also took 320 older combat aircraft and dramatically modernized them. And then during the same time frame, Russia did retire more than 2,000 Soviet-era aircraft. So, you know, it was a net decrease of a few hundred there, but the result is a fleet of aircraft that are 75% new or modernized, and that means a faster, a more, you know, nimble, more advanced, and ultimately a more lethal air force. And then this report also looks ahead at what we can expect from Russia going through the 2020s. It draws a lot of attention to the Su-57. That's a stealth fighter jet that's been years in production, and it looks like it could very soon be rolled out, and that can actually rival the F-35 in a number of ways. It also looks at various strategic bombers and combat drones. And then the last one I'll mention is a real favorite of aviation aficionados. That's the Tu-160 Global Strike Bomber. Those have the most powerful engine of any aircraft in military service anywhere in the world. And Russia has started production of them, so they'll be rolling out as many as 50 of those in the years ahead. But this report that we've been discussing from the Center of Naval Analysis, it does look ahead, as we just looked at, but using normal intelligence channels, you can really only see so far. And at the Trumpet, we use something that most forecasters and intelligence teams wouldn't think to use, and that is Bible prophecy. So if you look at Ezekiel 38, Revelation 9 and 16, also the books of Daniel and Joel, there is a picture that emerges of Russia in the end time, and it's at the head of what is a true military behemoth. The scriptures show that China and several other Oriental nations will end up pooling their resources together, and they'll remain separate nations under separate rulers. It's called the Kings of the East, but it will be mainly under Russia's command and under Putin's command. We know that from Ezekiel 38. And when you study all the relevant passages there, you see that as mighty as Russia's air force and the rest of its military is becoming today, it's still far less powerful than this mammoth Kings of the East power block will be in the future. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has a booklet all about that called The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo gave a speech in Washington this week that painted a stunning picture of an unknown dimension to Iran's support for terrorism. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, this was a very powerful speech before the National Press Club, and one where Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, decided to use the opportunity to showcase just how much Iran's relationship with al-Qaeda has flourished over the past 5 years, ever since the nuclear deal. Now, we've written stories about this, and even the 9/11 report said that the perpetrators of that attack that was done by al-Qaeda actually received a free pass through Iranian territory, meaning that there was some level of communication and aid that was given by Iran to al-Qaeda. However, the new information brought forward by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was that Iran has actually transformed into the new Afghanistan. Afghanistan was the home base for al-Qaeda during Osama bin Laden's time. Osama bin Laden, of course, would end up going to Pakistan where he'd be found. However, he quoted some of the words or a letter from Osama bin Laden himself, who said this, quote, "Iran is our main artery for funds, personnel, and communication." And so there, Iran was already, back when he was alive, a critical factor in aiding al-Qaeda. And what Mike Pompeo said is that since 2015 and the nuclear deal, Iran has become the safe haven, the hub from where al-Qaeda's leadership directs its cells worldwide. All the leaders of al-Qaeda are currently inside Iran. That is why the number two of al-Qaeda just got assassinated in August, and he publicly confirmed that was the case for the first time on Tuesday. And what's really interesting about this is it's not surprising at all to us, because we've been saying this all along, that Iran is the head of the terrorist snake. Even you yourself wrote back in 2001 in November in the Philadelphia Trumpet that unless Iran is targeted by the United States and Iran is taken out as this number one state sponsor of terrorism, al-Qaeda is still going to, and the terrorist snake is still going to be able to flourish. And so there's just a couple of things that he said that I could quote him. He said, since 2015, Iran has also given al-Qaeda leaders greater freedom of movement inside of Iran and under their supervision. The IRGC has provided logistical support, things like travel documents, ID cards, passports to enable al-Qaeda activity. Al-Qaeda has centralized its leadership inside Tehran. And so then he summarized this way. He said, you now have the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism, the Islamic Republic of Iran, as the home base for al-Qaeda. I would say Iran is the new Afghanistan, the key geographic hub for al-Qaeda, but it's actually worse. Unlike in Afghanistan when al-Qaeda was hiding in the mountains, al-Qaeda today is operating underneath the hard shell of the Iranian regime's protection. And so then he talked about how that everyone likes to play up this division between Sunni terrorists, which al-Qaeda is, and Shia terrorists, which Iran is, and that they don't get along. But then he said, towards the end, he said, 30 years of cooperation shows that Iran and al-Qaeda's divergent theology is no match for its convergent hatred. And so they are coming together right now. And he said, not every single attack that al-Qaeda does is directed by Iran, but Iran does sign off on them. And this opens up a new level of understanding of Iran's leadership over the terrorist world. It's al-Qaeda that has the relationship with al-Shabaab in the Horn of Africa. It's al-Qaeda that is very active in North Africa. It's al-Qaeda that's active in the Maghreb, just the border region of those North African states, the southern border. And so if you have Iran now leading al-Qaeda, one, it has some bit of plausible deniability that it is there, because not everyone will believe the Secretary of State. However, you see this strengthening of Iran's hold over the terrorists worldwide. Radical Islamic terrorism, Iran being the chief Sunni power and al-Qaeda being the chief Shiite power and al-Qaeda being the chief Sunni power in it, have come under the leadership of Iran. That's what Mike Pompeo just said. And this is something that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, has prophesied about. He said that Iran is going, and for 30 years, that Iran is going to lead radical Islam. We're getting to the point where there are no schisms in the radical Islamic camp, and it is going to be led directly from Iran. And that's basically what Mr. Mike Pompeo said this week.
Well, he talks all about it. Our editor-in-chief does, that is, Gerald Flory, in his booklet, The King of the South, the role that Iran plays in biblical prophecy and the support that it has for these terrorist groups. It is quite stunning, the information that Secretary Pompeo revealed this past week about that. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Brent. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Maria Edgeworth. If we take care of the moments, the years will take care of themselves. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.